Inspired by ESPN's anniversary, ESPN Films 30 for 30 is an unprecedented documentary series featuring 30 films from some of today's finest storytellers. Each filmmaker will bring their passion and personal point of view to their film, detailing the issues, trends, athletes, teams, rivalries, games, and events that transformed the sports landscape from 1979 to 2009. For more on 30 for 30, here's your host, Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the 30 for 30 series, the trial of Allen Iverson, premiering April 13th on ESPN, I think at 8 o'clock. I should probably know that. I'm only the host. On the phone right now, the director of that film, the one, the only, Steve James. What's happening?
Hey, how you doing, Bill?
You are currently at a screening right now for the film, and because you've probably seen it 170 times, you're standing outside the movie theater doing this podcast right now.
That's right. Yeah, I'm at the Full Frame Documentary Festival down in Raleigh, Durham. Duke Country. We won't get into that. But we have a packed house that the film just got underway, so I'm pretty excited.
Some of the guys who do the docs, they like being in the theater every time to see what the crowd reacts to. And then other people, it starts and they get the hell out of there. You seem to be in the latter class. Why don't you like hearing the reactions to people from people?
Well, you know what it is. I like to be in for a screening, you know, maybe two tops, just to see how it's playing and what the audience feels like. But even then, it's painful. Even when it's playing well, it's like, you know, every cough, you think, oh, that person's restless, or someone goes out, you think, they're not going to the bathroom, they're leaving, you know. So it can be nerve-wracking. You know, you want to tackle people that are leaving, say, wait, where are you going, you know.
Or but, somebody starts talking to a friend during it, you're like, shut up, my movie's on.
Exactly, you miss a good part, you know.
this is a really personal story for you. You grew up where Iverson went to high school, and, you know, this whole story, I cover sports for a living. I've been writing a sports column since 1997, and I didn't realize until I saw the first cut of this film how little I knew of the whole bowling alley incident and all that stuff. Like, for instance, the biggest misconception that I had was that Iverson had graduated high school, and then this happened. And actually, it happened between his junior and senior year, and he never had a senior year in high school. What do you think is the biggest thing people will learn from this film?
Well, I think that's some of what you're saying. I think also for a lot of people, who, especially those who maybe, you know, follow basketball and know Iverson's career as a professional, they don't know what his life was like as a kid, too. I think that's another thing that's a bit of a revelation for people because, you know, there's always those stories, and, you know, too many of those stories of athletes who come from hard backgrounds, right, and are able to overcome it and make it to the pros. But Allen's background was particularly hard and tough. And I think other things people are, you know, find out is that he was a terrific football player, not just a basketball player. And even though we didn't get Allen to participate in this film in an interview, you know, Allen is all over this film, and we were able to get some really great and precious footage about, from, like, when he got his graduation, you know, when he graduated with the help of a tutoring center and this really, you know, great woman named Sue Lambiot.
Yep. And the football footage to me, you know, there's a lot of things about this film, not just that I love, but just that I was like, oh, my God. And you see the football footage and you see the footage that you had from high school. Like, they, you know, they used to run a play coming out of the gate where it'd be basically a half-court alley-oop to him. And you see the kind of athletic ability this guy had when he was 17. I mean, we saw him as a pro. And he was one of the best basketball players of his generation. He was not as good of an athlete as he was in high school. It's amazing. How did you find all that footage?
Well, we had great cooperation on that front from the Hampton City Schools, you know, sports people that broadcast a lot of those games and still do to this day. And they were very cooperative, and they gave us a bunch of games, and we just started going through the games and looking for the highlights. And you know, some of it was spurred by interviews where, like, Coach Koz talked about some incredible play he made, so we went and sought that out specifically. But, you know, that's the thing. My dad, I knew about Allen Iverson, the football player, early on simply because my dad was such a huge fan of his despite the fact that he went to the wrong high school.
Yes.
He went to Bethel High School instead of Hampton, which is, you know, the school my dad went to and I went to. But he was such a huge fan, he started sending me clippings on this guy back when he was a football player, and of course saying he wished he played for Hampton. So, and then when basketball season rolled around, before this incident happened, he was sending me basketball clippings of him, like where he was alley-oop dunking, and he would write in his letter to me, "Do you realize this kid's not even 6 feet tall?"
Right. When what made you initially, you know, obviously we wanted you involved with 30 for 30, and you could have told us that, you know, you wanted to do an hour on watching paint dry, and we probably would have okayed it. What made you pick this story?
Well, you know, when Connor and John, that's who I met with, when they told me a bit of what you guys had in mind for this, which was, you know, you wanted to tell stories that happened in the last 30 years, that immediately ruled out Dr. J, which was another story I had in mind because he just missed that cut. But
yep.
When he was with the Squires. But, you know, when they said, like, it has to happen in the last 30 years, they want stories that, you know, really felt were important but had not really been told, and that they wanted it to be a story that had personal resonance, you know, for the filmmaker, that it was something you really felt you needed to tell, not just some story that would be a good story to tell. And when they said all that, this is the story I thought of, because, you know, when this was all happening 17 years ago, when I was finishing Hoop Dreams, I wanted to come back to my hometown and actually tell it then and start documenting it, but it was just not practical or possible. And so it suddenly this sort of lost opportunity to really look at what happened in my hometown and try to understand why it happened presented itself again.
I got to say that I'm glad you're telling it now after his career, that versus if you had told it in 1995, because I think part of the reason I liked it so much is it's really just fascinating to see 17-year-old Allen Iverson. You know, and somebody that was not the person that we came to know. He doesn't have the cornrows yet, didn't have all the tattoos, didn't have all the swagger yet, but definitely had some of it. And yet to see this guy, like, you know, coming out of the courtroom in handcuffs and things like that, like, it's, I don't think I've had an experience like this watching a documentary. It's just weird. You know, it's almost like reminds me of watching Lost when they have the alternate universe. Like, wow, Allen Iverson in handcuffs? The racial component of this, though, you're a white guy. You're telling a story that's about race, that's really about, you know, centered in the African-American community, that whole thing. How hard was it for you to approach it from that tack? White guy talking about black guys.
Well, you know, to kind of springboard off of what you were just talking about, I think that's one of the things by telling the story at this stage, at this point, 17 years down the road, makes it a very different film than I would have done back then. You know, back then, if I'd had the opportunity to go to Hampton and tell the story, we would have done it more like we did Hoop Dreams, which was we would have thrust ourselves into the middle of all this was going on and tell the story, and the race of the filmmaker would not have been an issue that we explored in any kind of open way, I doubt, in the film itself, just like we don't do it in Hoop Dreams, right? But because it was 17 years later, and because I was going back, and because you guys liked the idea of me telling this from a personal perspective, then it just followed that, you know, you needed to know a bit about me, about the fact that I played, you know, ball there myself. I averaged, you know, 22 points a game less than Allen Iverson. I still, but, you know, and that, you knew something about my background, about my parents, about where I come from, about the neighborhood I lived in. And I didn't want that to overwhelm the film at all, and I hope it doesn't for viewers, because I you know, the sender of this story obviously is Iverson and the community and what happened then. But I think it was important to acknowledge all that, and that perspective that I was coming to it from. And it becomes clearest most of all for me in the film at this moment when Joyce Hobson, who was an African-American activist who had dodged me for a year while we were making this film to do interviews, finally consented to sit down and interview. And you see in the film where I ask her why she avoided, why she didn't want to do it. And she says point blank, it's because you're a white journalist coming back to tell this story that, in her view, is a black story.
Yeah.
And so we talk about that in the film a little bit, and I think that's a very important moment in the film.
Iverson never cooperated, and you know, at the time, we couldn't really figure it out. We went in him all these different angles. I think ultimately this whole documentary is really good for him. And I think it's going to be good for when people look back at his career and as you pointed out earlier, just how difficult his childhood was and all the obstacles that he had to overcome to get to where he got. Now we realize that maybe this guy had some really deep problems going on these last 18 months, maybe in the last 2 years, and that might have been part of the reason he didn't cooperate. Did the stuff that happened to him this season, and the personal stuff that came out about all the stuff that he was going through, did that make you want to change the ending?
Well, we did change my last narration about 5 times over the last few months. You know, it started with, you know, one version had him leaving Memphis, and then a week later I had to re-record it, and it was he had rejoined Philly, and then after that it was he had left Philly, you know, so... I think, you know, what I think is that this film, in many respects, and I think it's kind of what you're saying, this film couldn't be more timely in a way in terms of looking at Alan, because this was such a defining moment in a young man's life. And I mean, he wasn't even a man at this point in time this happened. He was 17 years old. And, you know, this was such a defining moment going forward. I think when we look at him now, for those of us who have followed his career and followed some of the off-court troubles he's had, I think it's a real window into who Allen Iverson was. But it's also obviously a real window into the specific community of Hampton, and I think by extension into, you know, sort of everywhere USA, because I think at the heart of what this film's about is how when race is a factor in a situation like this, a racial bowling alley brawl, and all of that came out of it, is that oftentimes what happens is that blacks and whites are not even having the same conversation about what's important here. You know, white folks tended to want to focus on, show me the evidence, is he guilty or innocent? If he's guilty, then if the law says he needs to do prison time, then that's what he needs to do. Not every white person felt that way, and you meet people in the film that don't feel that way.
Yep.
But in the black community, ultimately, it was not really about whether Alan was guilty in this bowling alley brawl or not. It was whether the justice system in the city of Hampton was going to treat this kid fairly, guilty or innocent. And I think we have seen that kind of division happen time and time again in the many years since then with different, you know, incidences that involve race.
I don't want to give too much away of the film because I want people to experience, you know, their thoughts as they're going. I don't want to prejudice that. But you explore a couple of possible conspiracy theories about why the police and why the judicial system was so hard on Iverson from the evidence that they had versus how they reacted to it. And one of the theories that I actually really honestly believe might be true is that, as you pointed out earlier, he went to Bethel, which was,
right,
you know, kind of the crappy high school, the inner city high school. Hampton was like the big monolith that won all the titles. Iverson swings that as a junior. They win football state championship. They win basketball state championship. This guy is just a force of nature. He's completely turned Hampton high school sports on its head. And, you know, as you point out in the film, a lot of the people who are in charge of some of the legal decisions in Hampton were old Hampton grads, and all of a sudden this Bethel kid gets basically railroaded. Do you believe that happened?
Well, you know, here's the thing about conspiracy theories. They're virtually impossible to prove to be right or wrong. I mean, some of the ones that I detail in here are pretty outlandish.
Yes.
Hard to believe. The one you just spun out is one of the ones that is certainly not nearly so outlandish. And, you know, because I went to Hampton and know the position of Hampton High School in the community vis-a-vis Bethel, you know, it's absolutely plausible. And it's not necessarily, you know, its plausibility may not lie in an actual conspiracy, i.e., you know, they decided they were out to get him to stop him from coming back his senior year and winning another football and basketball title over Hampton teams, which were, except for Bethel, the best in the state in both those sports at that particular time.
Yeah.
But I think what it is that it's certainly compelling to make the case that if he had gone to Hampton and this happened, as Bob Hintz, an ex-coach says in the film, that it would not have happened, unfolded the way it did, that steps would have been taken to have this resolve itself differently. Because it is hard for me to believe, even as a Hampton High graduate, that they would have let two more state championships slip away.
Yeah.
Went to Hampton. But, you know, I have no proof of any of that. And the people who were involved feel very strongly and passionately that they, you know, treated this as simply a matter of, you know, a justice and crime and punishment situation that had nothing to do with where he went to school. You know, so you just have to kind of decide what you want to believe.
I can't remember the timing because I haven't seen the film in like about 6 weeks. Was this before or after the OJ trial?
This is right before.
Right before, right, okay.
About a year before. And there's an interesting thing that's in the DVD extras for the film, but it was in the film for a while, but I had to, when I trimmed it down, it fell away.
Yeah.
But at one point, there was a sports columnist who's passed away, who, when Alan was going through all this, he decided to reach out to the athlete that he thought could give Alan the best advice about how to deal with these situations, a guy that was from a tough neighborhood and had prevailed and really succeeded in life. And so he called up O.J. Simpson
right, and
wrote a column about it.
Wow. Because a lot of the elements of the Iverson thing, as you pointed out a little bit ago, you know, there were some of those things in the O.J. thing as well, where you had
absolutely, the
white community believing one thing and the black community believing another thing. Now, in this case, the Iverson case, I think the black community was much more justified because this was clearly a young guy getting railroaded. And it just wasn't fair, and it didn't seem fair at the time. Why did it take so long to rectify what happened here?
Well, I have my own ideas about all this, and I can't prove any of it, but I think that my feeling is that, you know, a decision was made on the part of the courts and the prosecution. I'm not saying they were in collusion about it, but I think there was a decision made that if Alan's guilty, and, you know, it's a Rashomon kind of trial, you can look at this trial and kind of decide who you want to believe. But if he's guilty, and they decided he was guilty, that he needed to really pay a price for it. And I think that everything sprang from that. And the roots of that were that Alan was perceived, even before this incident happened, as an athlete who could get away with anything.
Yep.
He could get away with not going to school. He could get away with hanging out with guys who were involved in drugs and doing bad things, you know, that he was untouchable because of his athletic prowess. And so when this happened, and he was arrogant to boot, promising state championships and being the kind of in-your-face athlete that we all know and many of us love, right?
Yeah.
And so I think when this happened, there was a feeling that this guy needs to pay a price, and whatever that means. And so, you know, that's why when, after his conviction, I think they didn't let him out on bond pending appeal, because I would bet that there was some concern that he might get pardoned by the governor, Douglas Wilder, you know, that he might somehow slip out of ever paying a price for this. And so everything kind of sprang from there is sort of my opinion. Again, just opinion.
In one of the early rough cuts, I think, I'm pretty sure, it did not include his speech that he gave last summer at his camp, where he broke down. I remember that you were going there to film it, kind of hoping maybe he'd say one or two things. Now, at this point in the film, you didn't really have any indication from him personally how all this stuff had affected him over the years. And what he gave you at that press conference, I mean, it kind of fell out of the sky. Were you watching that thinking, oh, my God?
Yeah, oh, yeah, absolutely. No, it's in many respects, that moment is gets at the heart of what, if Alan had been willing to participate informally in the film,
yeah,
that we would have wanted him to talk about. And he's, you know, I think the thing about Iverson is he is such an unguarded athlete. You know, I mean, he's one of the few contemporary athletes that I can think of, and you're way more knowledgeable about this than me, so you may differ on this, but he's one of the few contemporary athletes I can think of who is so candid and honest and wears his emotions so outwardly and is not sort of packaged and handled to the point of, you know, being completely vanilla and boring. And it's one of the things I really like about him.
I couldn't agree more. And actually, in my basketball book, that was one of the themes in the part I wrote about him. I think him and Mike Tyson were the two most self-aware athletes of how society viewed them. That, and they never got credit for that. That Iverson always knew how he was perceived. He was very articulate about it. He was very articulate about the things that he felt, and his place in white society versus black society, stuff like that. I just thought he was, in his prime, I thought he was the most fascinating guy of that generation. And I've written this, but if I could have spent, a week doing a magazine feature on anybody with full access, it would have been Iverson. I just think the guy's riveting. I don't know if you remember, well, you probably do, Stephen A. Smith's first, quite frankly, show. He had Iverson for an hour, and it was like the guy is just captivating. And I'm not sure, I look at the film that you finished now. If you had interviewed him, he probably would have had so much good material in that interview. I don't know if that would have totally changed the complexion of the film or not. What do you think?
I think you're right. I mean, it would have made it a different film. And so I have conflicting feelings about it. On the one hand, I would love nothing better than to sit down and talk to Allen Iverson, for all the reasons you just talked about. And because of having done this story, I wouldn't want to talk to him about the trial, really. I would want to talk to him about how he perceived his place in that community prior to this incident and after, and what has been the impact that he has felt from that time through his life. And, those are the kind of things I'm interested in talking to him about. But you're right. If I had gotten him, he would have overwhelmed the film in some ways, and it would have been less a film about community, probably, and more about Allen himself. And I think I really like the film we've ended up with, because Allen's voice is very much heard. I mean, we even excerpted a little piece of the Stephen A. Smith when he talked about this stuff. And, his voice is all over the film, but it allows the film that we made to really be more focused on the community and how the community perceived him and what was the fallout of that. Because ultimately, I think that's the story that could have the greatest resonance for people. And I'm excited about the fact that a film like this is going to be on ESPN, in the heart of sports-loving, fans. To see a film like this that really, steers away from being more of a strict biography of Allen Iverson and focuses more on these other things is really exciting to me.
My dream scenario, I think, would have been the film the way it is, but immediately after it ended, like a 45-minute sit-down interview with Iverson that starts right after he finishes watching the film for the first time. Obviously, it's not going to happen, but I mean, I just think the package of those two. Maybe. Where is it?
Here's my dream scenario. You call him up and you interview him for 45 minutes. You still got a few days. So.
I would love it. Where is he? Let's get him in a studio.
I think you're dead on. That would be the right way to do it.
Were you worried that, something really tragic was going to potentially happen to him in the weeks leading up to this film? Like, I didn't know if he was going to go to rehab, something that dramatically would have kind of changed what we just saw.
Yeah. I think everybody who admires him or follows him as an athlete and likes him is worried about him.
I am. Yeah.
Partly because you don't know where the exact truth is. You may be more up on it than me, but from what I've read is he's denied certain things that have been written recently about his problems. It may be true, it may be not true. I'm not in a position to know. But I do know that I think a lot of people that have been close to Allen over the years, at least from the Hampton community, are concerned about him,
And yeah.
So I think a lot of people who know him really are praying and hoping for the best for this guy.
I think the guy's in major trouble. And I also think, we got a taste of it as we tried to deal with his camp, trying to get him to participate in this because, this is a good documentary for him. This kind of, in my opinion, is going to change how people perceive their last 15 years that they spent following this guy. And it just seemed like that the people around him, you hate to judge people by the people that they surround themselves with, but they just did not seem really on the ball at all. And I don't know. I wonder how different his life would be if, it kind of reminds me of Mike Tyson a little bit, where Customano died with Tyson, and all of a sudden he had people surrounding him that just weren't up for the challenge. And I get the feeling that this has kind of happened here. Do you agree?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I'm doing this other film now where it's about urban violence in cities and focusing in Chicago where I live. And one of the things that's come out that's really been a bit of a revelation to me is because I'm spending time with guys who have done seriously bad things in their life and served time for everything from assault and burglary to murder. And they're now out there doing really good things, and they've turned their lives around, right? And Allen Iverson never did anything close to what these guys,
right,
you know, did. But there's one sort of quality that every one of them that we've spent time with has that I don't know that Allen ever really had. And it is that early on had a strong and really positive and good influence in their life that could see them through and give them the kind of foundation that they could eventually return to no matter how far they strayed.
Yeah.
I think that's the one thing that Allen Iverson may not have had in his life, and I think it may be the thing that he still needs. That's why when he went to Georgetown, I think the best thing that could have happened to him was having John Thompson in his life. You know,
yeah,
because he seemed like the right kind of coach at the right time. But he was only there for 2 years, and then he moved on, you know. And so
I this is going to sound weird, but I kind of feel like the Philly fans were like that for him to some degree, because they were the only people that really seemed to totally understand him and who judged him by his strengths more than his weaknesses. And once he left that, I don't think his life's been the same. Philly just got him for whatever reason. They just got him. You know, I think it was you were talking about, I'm almost positive this is your theory about how Philly, the three athletes that it's had, the three biggest athletes, Barkley, Iverson, and then who was the other one? How they kind of represent Philly in some weird way. Was that your theory?
It wasn't, but if it's a really good theory, I'd be happy to take credit for it.
Who was the third one? I can't remember. Was it Barkley, Iverson, and... Okay. I can't remember. Anyway, let's talk about Hoop Dreams for a second, because that was really the granddaddy of all the sports documentaries. I can't even remember. Was there a major sports documentary that was well received before Hoop Dreams? I can't even remember.
I don't think so. I could be wrong, but nothing springs to mind. I mean, you have to understand at that time when we were making Hoop Dreams and trying to get funding for Hoop Dreams.
Yeah.
One of the hurdles was that people didn't think it was about a serious enough topic. You know, documentaries at that time, it was a very different time than it is now, you know. People who might fund it, foundations and such, they wanted the documentary to be about, you know, poverty in the inner city, but it would be, you know, just about poverty. You know what I mean? To get at some of those things that went on in life in the inner city and the struggles, the American dream and race and all those things, they weren't looking for you to get at that through a film that's about kids wanting to play basketball.
Right.
And I think it was a hurdle. But we don't have those hurdles anymore, thank God, because you can see a documentary on just about anything now. But at that time it was particularly hard.
And, you know, one of the things that was going on there, besides the whole documentary thing, it almost feels like a reality show when you rewatch it. And I'm thinking back, like, so that came out, I'm going to say, 92, 93, somewhere in the 92, 93 range, right?
94.
Oh, 94. So Real World had been on for, I don't know, maybe a year or 2 years, but we're still kind of coming to grips with the whole part of, all right, this camera is just going to be on these people, and there's no scripted story, and it's just going to happen and unfold. And you were right but you'd been working on this for, what, 3-4 years at that point?
Well, yeah, we started shooting in 87.
Okay. Yeah, 87 years. What made you think that this was going to work?
I don't know. You know, it was one of those things where I had always been a fan of Michael Apted's series, the 35 up, 48 up, on and on, where every 7 years he checks in with these folks that he started when they were 7 years old. And I'd always loved this idea of seeing someone grow up before the camera as a result of that. And so I think that was in the mix. But then I think when we first started filming and we went with Arthur Agee out to St. Joe's with the street scout, Earl Smith, and Arthur plays at the camp and he plays Isaiah his hero, and then he meets with the coach, and the coach, Pingator, there says, you know, if you look after the grades and if you develop, you know, play basketball, in 4 years I can help you get to college. It was such an extraordinary promise to make to a kid like this who he had just met.
Yeah.
And played for 20 minutes. And at that time, it just sort of, the light went off for us, and I think we kind of said, wouldn't it be amazing if we could somehow be there 4 years from now to see if this all comes to pass for this kid?
Right.
And I think, so that was where the idea was born, and then we didn't have any money. We had no idea if we could even do it, or if we did it, how frequently we could check in, or any of that. But we just started trying to do it, and it just kind of mushroomed and became this, its own thing, you know.
How did you pick the two players that you ended up with?
Well, we found them pretty much how you see in the film, which is, the original idea was to do a film focused on a single basketball court, where there would be dreamers like Arthur and William. There would be ex-players who are washed up, like, you know, turns out, you know, William's brother Curtis in the film. And there would be maybe a pro player that came off that court or out of that neighborhood, like an Isaiah Thomas. And so we went out looking for courts. And Earl Smith was our guide to find the best courts to consider to focus the film around. And it was while we were out with Earl, he saw Arthur. And he was like, ooh, this kid, I like this kid. And we're like, which kid? What kid? You know, he could see Arthur's future talent at a point in time where I was looking at him. I mean, I played ball, and I'm like, that kid? Like, what's so special about him? So I was, oh, he's got a fast first step. You know, he could be something. And we were just so fascinated with what he was doing. And he said, I'm going to take him out to meet Coach Pingator. You know, we were like, well, maybe we should just follow along, you know, and see what happens. And so we did. And the conception of the film changed literally the first day. We realized that we didn't want to follow a basketball court. We wanted to follow kids leaving those courts, in essence, and trying to pursue their dream. And so when we got out to St. Joe's and did the camp with Pingator that I mentioned earlier, you know, Ping said, yeah, the kid's raw, he's got some ability, but I got this other kid coming in named William Gates. I think he could be really something. So I said, well, let's meet him. And so we met William, and William was agreeable, and his family was agreeable. And so we just started following both these kids. Again, we had no money, and we thought, well, maybe one of them will be interesting, not realizing, of course, that both would be quite interesting.
So what were you doing for money at the time? How are you getting food on the table?
Well, I started out as a production assistant when I moved to Chicago on TV commercials, and had such extraordinary jobs as stocking the cooler on shoots and sweeping up the set and loading out the trash. I was the most educated production assistant in Chicago.
Right.
I had an MFA in film at that point. But I just kind of worked my way up the food chain on the commercial side, because the beauty of that work is it's freelance, so you can kind of work for a while and then not work. And I made a lot more money doing that than I would have taken a retail job at, you know, Walden Books or something. And so I would do that work, and then, you know, I'd get a few weeks and could go spend a few weeks working on hoop trains. And that's kind of the way it happened. We eventually got some funding, but never enough to live off of, but it at least eased the burden a bit.
What, looking back at it now, it's been 16 years, what's the biggest thing you would change about that movie?
About Hoop Dreams?
Yeah, the choices that you made in it.
Well, I don't think anybody's really ever asked me that. That's something, too. I've been asked a lot of questions about Hoop Dreams. what I changed? Well, you know, I mean, I don't think it hurts the movie, but I learned a valuable lesson on Hoop Dreams about documentary filmmaking early on, which was when Arthur went out to St. Joe's to go to school, we didn't document much of his classroom stuff. We put it off thinking we'd get it later, and then he was kicked out of the school and we never got it. And I learned this valuable lesson that when you're following real life, never assume anything.
Yep.
If it's there, you get it. And so there's things, you know, there's a little bit of smoke and mirrors in the film, in the first part of the film, that, you know, to kind of get us through that. But in some ways it ended up being a blessing, because we didn't, if we didn't have the material, I mean, my God, the film was 3 hours long as it is. If we'd had all that material, who knows how long this film would have ended up being.
Right.
But there is one scene. There is one scene that I wish was in the movie. For some unknown reason, I can't figure out why we left it out. And when there's a new DVD, it'll come out on Who Cares. It'll be in there. But he went and at the time we were filming, they did this TV movie called The Mary Thomas Story. Did you ever see that?
Yes.
That film. Okay. About Isaiah Thomas's mom. You know.
Yeah. Who played her? I can't. Somebody famous who played her. I can't remember who.
But,
it was somebody.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. Anyway, so they had an open casting call to find someone to play Arthur. I mean, to play Isaiah. And Arthur heard about it. And because Isaiah was his hero, and because Arthur was such a comedian and a funny guy, he went down and auditioned for us. And so we had him auditioning to play his hero, Isaiah Thomas, in a TV movie. And then the TV movie went, he didn't get it, but he was pretty good. And the TV movie went and filmed at St. Joseph's, where Isaiah played. And we filmed them filming the movie at St. Joseph's in the gym. And it was just this whole life imitates art, imitates life
right.
kind of moment that's very funny in many respects. You know, Pingator showing an actor how to play him, you know, and putting some steel in the guy's spine because he was a little too wimpy. It was just a very funny scene, and it, you know, like I say, it'll eventually get into the light of day, but I wish it was in the movie.
All right, when we were doing some of the promotion early on for 30 for 30, I remember seeing, like, the bios, and I think I even may have sent somebody an email. You forgot to put that Steve James won an Academy Award for Hoop Dreams. All these years had passed, and somehow gotten the story twister out of my... You didn't even get nominated.
No, well, we did get nominated for editing.
But, I mean, you didn't get nominated for Best Documentary.
No, it caused an uproar. It ended up being the best thing that could have happened to the film, because after that snub, it became an even bigger news story because people were outraged, you know, that it actually got the attention of far more people, and people said, what is it with this film? I guess I do need to go see this film, because people are all... been out of shape over it not getting nominated.
Right. Yeah, I mean, did they even have the best documentary category? Was it this? Because I remember something about they changed the rules or something after what happened to your film.
Something. They changed it. They did have best documentary category, but it was mostly dominated by older Academy members and a handful of people that work in documentary. And, you know, there was an expose article done in, you know, Entertainment Weekly or something that tried to get at the heart of what happened. And, you know, I can't repeat the conspiracies because they sound plausible, but
yeah.
I don't really know. But they did, as a result of that, they really made a concerted effort to change the way it's done and to really open the documentary wing of the Academy to real active documentary filmmakers. So it is a lot better as a result of that.
You caught one huge break in that film, which I'm convinced when you do these films, these sports documentaries where you're following people, you got to get lucky. And Arthur Agee's team making their improbable Butler-like run down the Illinois State Championship. I mean, what were the odds of that going in? Did you have any idea that was going to happen?
No. I mean, Marshall is a proud program with a proud history in Chicago Public League. But that team the year before was no great shakes, and no one was expecting them. They're in the most powerful and competitive division in the public league, the Red West. And
yeah.
For them to come out of the Red West and win the Red West and then win the city championship and get downstate and play third totally shocked everybody, and including us. Yeah, no, I mean, the documentary gods smiled on us. And yes, you do need, you make your luck to some degree, because if you're not there and if you're not paying attention, if you're not thinking ahead, you miss a lot of great stuff. But
yeah.
Something like that was a gift that fell from the gods. I'll never forget the reviewer in The Nation, that left-wing periodical.
Yeah.
When he reviewed the film, Stuart Clowen, I think his first line in the review was that Hoop Dreams had a script written by God.
It's true. I remember I haven't seen it probably, I think, two and a half years. It's never on anymore. I wish it was on. But there's that one, they play that one game, and they're going basically against the Twin Towers. Yeah. And it was Thomas Hamilton, and I can't remember the other guy's name. These guys were both 7 feet tall. It was a high school game, and it was, like, absurd. It was had a central casting. The other thing I remember is I think William goes to the McDonald's camp or one of those camps, and it's probably
the Nike camp,
and I'm going to say it's, like, I don't know, 1989, 1990, somewhere in that range, and it's like a murderer's row of guys you'd recognize now. It's like Chris Webber, Juwan Howard, Jalen Rose, all these guys. It's just kind of cool to see all of them again, you know?
Well, and I'll tell you, that's the thing about William. People ask me, do you really think he would have made it to the pros without the knee injury? I don't have the names memorized at all that were on the list, but if you look at the list of the top 10 players, rising juniors, you know, at the end of William's sophomore year, they, you know, USA Today did, like, you know, here are the top 10 rising juniors for next year. I think 8 of the 10 guys in that list are in the NBA. William's list. And William was an extraordinary talent, but he was a kid, I think, that in many respects was snake bit with bad luck. And he also had the misfortune of having watched his brother, Curtis, go through the system with a lot of promise in his own right and then crash. And I think he always kind of, because of that, he kind of kept the dream at arm's length to protect himself. He was always reluctant to fully embrace what it could be.
Yeah. It reminded me a little bit of Sebastian Telfair, who also had the older brother playing overseas who never quite made it. We did a documentary about him.
Yeah.
And kind of the same thing. It's actually not a good thing to have the older guy make it, but not really make it, because you just have the guard up. But I remember the last shot, this book that Darcy Fry wrote that I loved in the 90s.
Yeah.
He followed the Coney Island high school guys. And unlike with you, with William, where, you know, I think if William had become a really successful NBA player, that would have totally changed how people perceive that film now. In that book, Stephon Marbury is like a ninth grader who ends up becoming Stephon Marbury. And when you read it, you know, after the fact, it's really weird to see him as the 15-year-old. I think let's say William Agee makes it and has like a 12-year NBA career. How does that change how people perceive that film?
That's a good question. That's a very good question. I think in some ways you're asking me a question that I haven't been asked.
It's my job.
It's your job, man. It's, you know, it's like, in some ways, I think it might diminish what the film has to say.
Yeah.
Especially for young players. You know, the thing about William is, and of course that last line, which is, you know, when I heard it, I knew it would be the last line in the movie, when William says, people say to me, when you make it to the NBA, don't forget about me. And I say to them, well, if I don't make it, don't forget about me. That line sums up the film.
I would argue that it was better for the film that he didn't make it, as sad as it is that he didn't make it. It helped the overall cost. We got to run. Well, you got to go back to your screening, and we got the studio open up. Unfortunately, we can't keep going. Allen Iverson, April 13th, the trial of Allen Iverson. Couldn't be prouder to be involved with this film. I think it's great, and I think it's a must-watch. We really appreciate the work you did, and I hope you had a good time working on it.
Oh, it's fantastic. It was a great concept, and you guys are totally living up to the concept, too. That's what's remarkable. It's like what you set out to do is exactly what you're doing, and it's just a great series, and I'm honored to be a part of it.
All right, well, thank you. Well, we're honored to have you. Good luck, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right. Take care, Bill.
What if I told you that for 3 glorious years, football season never ended? That a marching band played a 12-year halftime show? What if I told you that a rugby scrum could help heal a nation? Or that the guy sitting in aisle 4, row 8, seat 113 was going to be more famous than anyone on the field? What if I told you that a movie could change the way you look at sports? From ESPN Films, 30 stories, 30 filmmakers, 30 years. ESPN 30 for 30, presented by Levi's, continues Tuesday at 8 Eastern on ESPN.